Hello and welcome to Intrigue Explained, the Understanding China, part one of 536, the Two Sessions edition. So with me again today this week is Dmitry Grozbinski, the founder of the trade platform Explain Trade. We know this intro by now. Dmitry, how are you?
I am very well. How are you, John?
Very well, thank you. Helen, my co-founder at International Intrigue, joining us as always. How are you, Helen?
Good day, John. How you doing?
Good, good. I'm actually the one on the road this week. Normally it's your role to be somewhere in the world, Helen, but I'm in London this week, so that will explain my perhaps less than clear audio and perhaps my also very tired opinions. I'm going to use that as an
Oh, if you're
excuse
talking about
anyway.
your appearance,
And my
I was going
appearance.
to give you an excuse for that, but.
It's a blanket excuse for my poor performance, essentially. But yeah, so we're here again this week to kind of chat about all things geopolitics. This week, I think we're going to do something a little bit different, a bit of a deep dive on the recent Chinese two sessions, legislative sessions. We're going to explain what that even means, firstly, because I think even for folks who watch China, it can be pretty confusing. And we're going to kind of sort of just unpick what happened and what it means and sort of hopefully bring some clarity to the situation for all of you folks. But first, I want to talk very briefly about the TikTok potential divestiture ban in the US and where that's going. But we wrote about this in International Intrigue this week. My first question to both of you is, do you have any general thoughts on whether TikTok should be banned in the US? And then secondly, are you surprised that it's happening? So maybe Helen.
Yeah, you know me, I love TikTok. As a product, as a consumer, I think it's a great product. Look, it's a lot of fun, and you can see why it's so sticky, right? And that's part of the problem. Now, just to zoom back a bit, I think we've been here before, right? This isn't the first time this has been floated, and I want to clarify that it's not a ban per se. It's pushing for TikTok to be sold from its parent company, ByteDance, which is a Chinese company. So, in 2020, I think 20 or 2021, we had seen sort of the US pushing for it to be sold to either the Oracle or Microsoft or a US company that is not linked to the CCP. And that failed for, a whole bunch of reasons. And I think the compromise that was reached was that, TikTok said that they would process US consumer data in the US. So that was kind of seen as a workaround then. But of course, since then, we've seen TikTok reach even more American users. And that narrative and understanding of its very non-transparent algorithm concern both sides of the aisle. Well, actually, except for the Republicans, but we can come back to that later. So look, I think they should be sold. I think that the problem isn't so much the sort of general kind of trust and safety issues that we have with all user-generated content platforms. It's more the fact that there is a link to the parent company, sorry, ByteDance, to the CCP that is not something that TikTok can control, no matter how smooth the sort of Singaporean, he's not Chinese, Singaporean president or CEO of TikTok appears to be, right? So I really think that they should try and push for it. I don't know whether on a technical sort of, process level it's going to go through because I think TikTok are going to push back. The Senate might take a while. And Trump, if he gets in November, might even reverse it. So that's my sort of two cents on that.
Dmitry, Helen's done a great job of explaining eloquently what the situation is, but as per usual, refuses to take a headline-grabbing stand and is far too reasonable and moderated in her opinions. Should it be
No,
banned
I think I said
because everyone hates
yes.
China, Dmitry? Yeah, but you said it moderatedly. You didn't give me anything to blast you with later on.
Look, I think the headline here is that Helen hates the youth, fun, and free
There we
speech. And
go.
I think that's what we
Thank
should run
you.
with.
Excuse me, my title at Google at one stage was the global youth expert. I'm a glow yo-yo expert. I love
And
the
that's
youth.
why Google's going down the pipes, huh?
Exactly.
God, we could do an entire episode on this because it's so complicated. First of all, the point that Helen makes that it's a divestment, not a ban, is correct. Though I have heard the counter argument put to me that, hold on, if you order a company of this size to divest at effectively gunpoint or legislation point, the number of potential buyers out there is vanishingly small, and the
Right.
chances that you will get anything approaching a fair price is minuscule. And so some are saying, look, it's effectively a ban because it's not like anyone's going to come in and pay full price for this thing when there's a certain number of days before that it must divest in. And the sheer size of what TikTok is means that there aren't that many buyers. So I think that's an important point that I think it's too easy to go, oh, no, it's just divestment. There is at least an argument that it is, in fact, more than that. and that the buyer, the potential buyers are kind of like Facebook and maybe Alphabet that have
their
own. And
Microsoft, I think, still.
And Microsoft, who all have their own sort of motivations for potentially picking this thing up. I think that's important. The second distinction, and I think this is sort of to support Helen's point, is why TikTok in terms of influencing the public is more dangerous when it comes to its algorithm than a lot of other things. And I say this as someone who uses TikTok obsessively. I love it. But the stream I'm getting on my TikTok feed is almost entirely algorithmically generated based on a pool of global users. The stream I get on Twitter, for example, or on Facebook, or even on Instagram is primarily driven by the people that I have actively chosen to follow. That limits, for example, Elon Musk's ability to shape my feed. Because if my feed is just people I have actively chosen to follow and the people they have chosen to interact with, overwhelmingly, that is significantly less control over what I am consuming than if an algorithm takes everything that is out there in the universe and just keeps serving it to me in 15-second increments. So I think that is something to think about.
So wait, your point there is that it's much easier for the let's be sort of generic and say TikTok slash ByteDance. It's much easier for them to manipulate what you see because they can control where it's coming from because it's not coming from your friends and you don't know the people it's coming from.
Absolutely. So TikTok is in some ways closer to the YouTube suggestion algorithm. Right. You know, there's a lot of documented things, and I'm sorry, Helen, as a former Googler, I don't mean to take a shot at you here, but I love it. The sort of pipeline of where you start on fitness videos, and if you keep clicking suggestions within 6 months, you're watching far right, like Andrew Tate content. The TikTok algorithm kind of is the same thing because it's drawing from a global audience.
Well, I think the bigger point here is that may well be true, and I'm sure is true, but also we don't know how the algorithm works at all.
Exactly.
It could well work like that. It certainly works like that in the broadest possible strokes, but I have not seen, and I don't think anybody who knows what they're talking about has any idea of what level of manipulation ByteDance, TikTok, the CCP can exert over TikTok. And I think most of us assume it's pretty high because when you go to China, you know, there's a couple of anecdotal, you know, cases where when the Hong Kong protests were happening, not the protests, sorry, I think it was more when the laws were passing and this kind of stuff in the 2021, Helen, something like
2021,
that.
2021, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That if you searched on TikTok for Hong Kong or like all this kind of stuff, there was literally nothing that came
That's
up.
Right.
And it's, and you know, the argument is, oh, well, it's a global algorithm. We're just serving you content. Like, it is utterly implausible that there wasn't posts from folks involved in that situation. So we know anecdotally that there is definitely the ability to manipulate it, but we don't know how. So I think that's one problem. The second problem, I just come out and say, like, I think it's insane that America hasn't banned TikTok. Utterly insane for like multiple reasons. But one, China has long banned Facebook and all these kinds of social media.
Back in like 2011, right? Or 2000.
And TikTok.
And yeah, exactly.
Facebook, Yahoo, Google, Microsoft operates there, but it's like not competitive because it's been neutered essentially. And, you know, people make, to Dimitri's point, people make the same argument. Well, it's actually, these aren't actually banned in China. Mm. They have to have 100% Chinese owned partner to operate through to get a license to operate. And you can do that. Microsoft has done it, but it's effectively a ban, right? They've chosen not to operate under those conditions. I would say, I think it's a little different in the US. You know, saying it's a divestiture is what folks I think are saying to kind of get around the idea that the US government is putting its thumb on the scale of free commerce. Mm-hmm. But I do think that they have been given a chance to get maybe not full market price, Dimitri, I accept that point. But I mean, they're going to make a ton of cash out of this if they are able to sell it. Well, if they're forced to sell it. Let's be honest, they're not going to sell it because China won't let it be sold.
Exactly.
But if they were, they would get a ton of money. And I think that's a pretty fair point for the US to say, hey, you can't operate with clear CCP involvement in something that can shape global narratives and opinions in our country. And the lobbying effort to kind of push back on it is just like every single lobbyist on their team should be immediately fired for the argument of like, we can't manipulate the American system. You shouldn't ban TikTok. By the way, we're going to put a pop-up on every user to call their congressperson and influence 100%. The political system. The last thing I'll say is I was reading an article by a very, very well-known tech PR guru. She used to work, I think, at potentially at Facebook or something like that. But she's become one of the like leading figures on how you deal with PR if you're a tech firm. And she basically said the general rules, and I'm going to paraphrase and probably get it wrong here, but it's one, if you're a domestic American firm, you basically highlight your size, highlight your impact on the economy, motivate your users to influence Congress, and show how integrated you are into, you know, everything that goes on. And that's the way you pressure Congress, because if banning them or whatever it is that they're trying to do will have real effects for the American economy. TikTok used that playbook because that's presumably what they, you know, they just rolled out what's been done before, except it's the absolute opposite because their size is the problem. Their ability to influence American people is the problem. Their ability to influence the American legislative system is the actual problem. So what they've done, they literally should have done the absolute opposite, which is stay quiet, get on the phones quietly, manipulate quietly, don't do anything that seemed to be publicly influencing anything, and try and work the system behind closed doors. So,
can I make one point though, John? And I think sort of not so much in TikTok's defense, but I do think that one thing that makes this debate quite weird and unpleasant externally is it's very hard to work out what the actual argument that is being put forward officially is. Is the issue that the data is going back to Beijing potentially, or is the issue the influence? And I think the proponents of the ban are playing a kind of shell game where, in the same way that often happens with political debates, are like, are guns there to overthrow the government if it goes rogue, or are they there to defend your home, or are they there for hunting? In the same way, it's like, is the issue that TikTok is manipulating the youth? Is the issue that it is a security risk because some general's daughter's phone could be activated as a microphone to listen in on his conversations? Is the issue that China is able to gather data? I think that there is a little bit of murkiness around that.
I think it's all of the above, right, Dim? Why does it have to be just one, you know, reason for this to be a compelling argument? I think that all of the things you've identified are very, very real threats and worthy of, you know, this consideration.
Yeah, I agree with you, Helen. I think it is both, but I think it's far more the latter. I think people smarter than me about this essentially say it is of Beijing / TikTok / ByteDance is collecting data by, you know, it asks for all those permissions on your iPhone or Android or whatever. But I don't think that's Beijing's primary interest in it. I think it's kind of like, Oh, well, if we can collect this data, why wouldn't we? But I don't think there's an element of, you know, maybe down the line that what the scenario you raised, Dimitri, is a possibility. But I don't think that's necessarily the biggest problem that folks have, because then it is very similar to Facebook and the other, apart from it's not American owned, it's very similar to every social media giant. The issue is, I think, and this is the issue that I think I agree with you, legislators aren't being clear enough, or some legislators aren't being clear enough, is that the global algorithm, which you described, that can be manipulated, the evidence that they have done this in the past to promote pro-Beijing lines mm-hmm. and to basically censor anti-Beijing lines, and mm-hmm. three, the ubiquity of it in terms of a news / information disseminator in America, particularly among young people, is such a critical risk to an open and free society that it is absolutely nuts to let a foreign adversary, which let's be honest, that's what China is, have the ability to put their finger on that scale. And it's not a new thing. I mean, the famous example in this debate is that Rupert Murdoch had to become an American citizen before he could own, you know, News Corp, Fox, that suite of products. Like, countries have long understood that there needs to be some national alignment with who owns your media, who influences what's covered in the media, and your national interest. Now, it's a difficult conversation in democracies because you don't want to be pushing state-sponsored information, but you also can draw a line at saying, no, we're free enough that we let China manipulate the conversation. But
to be clear there, 40% of US teens, right, get their news source from TikTok, which is a staggering amount.
I got radicalized on this when my feed, which is like animals, Warhammer, video games, like very
anodyne. Hot guys cooking. What?
Yeah, cooking shows. And then one day I just opened up my feed and it was nothing but US is about to have a civil war over the Texas border. Like when there was that tussle, which led to nothing.
Dying days of the Roman Empire.
It was like the National Guard had like a 10-minute standoff until a federal judge issued a ruling on where they could build barbed wire. But my feed was like, we are about to see Abrams tanks rolling across California kind of thing. And I'm like, okay, this is not this, I mean, it's an anecdote and it's something's going on here. But it feels like somebody is putting their thumb on the scale.
For the record, I'm not addicted to Reels, and I think Reels is just as bad. I think they've taken that sticky algorithm and that does that sort of like global suggested push comment, content, as opposed to your what your friends are up to.
It's all poison for the brain, Helen. It's all poison.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Just like sugar.
As the resident old man who's not on Instagram and has never been on TikTok, I can, you know, I sit here in my chair saying you're all poisoning your brains while I, listen to podcasts and, you know, watch golf videos on YouTube. So anyway, let's leave it there. I think we could, as you said, Dimitri, we could probably talk for hours on that. I honestly think it's one of the most fascinating issues in the world this year. It's such a microcosm of all of the kinds of challenges that we're going to face internationally and geopolitically, you know, in the decades as kind of information wars and different systems clash. But anyway, let's get to our main topic today, which is the two sessions in China. We're going to switch around the roles a little bit here. Dimitri is going to play the kind of my role, which is contrarian normie who doesn't understand what's going on. That's normally my role, but Dimitri's going to fake that role this week as Helen and I kind of try to bring you some explanation of what just went on in China. So I spent about 4 years in China as an Australian diplomat, obviously, at Beijing and Shanghai, kind of worked directly on covering these legislative sessions, both at a local level in Shanghai and then, you know, kind of helping out on the reporting that we used to do on the Beijing sessions. And obviously, Helen, you want to sort of establish your China bona fides so people will listen to us with some kind of authority.
I mean, I was a Chinese or Asia studies major in undergraduate and had spent my earlier years working in Beijing and in Hong Kong as a lawyer. And then I actually went back to Hong Kong to serve at our consulate general there for Australia in 2019 and covered sort of political economic issues, including the extradition protests and subsequent national security laws. So, you know, that was a very momentous time in Hong Kong's history.
For our sins, then, we've had to appraise ourselves of these systems, and I mean, I'll put my cards on the table. Incredibly tedious sessions, often.
Correct.
We have some experience in them. Okay, so Dimitri, I'm going to hand it over to you to kind of take this conversation where you want to go and what you find interesting, so that we don't just drone on with insider knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, I've been really excited to do this session. In my head, I call this like Understanding China, episode one of 6,800. Because, you know, we have this bizarre situation where the entire future of the next century is going to be defined by competition between the US, which we understand like forensically well and can rattle off the sort of polling in individual Senate races, and China, which at least I barely understand at all. And I think not to be patronizing, I think that's true for a lot of people. It's an opaque system. People only have a very vague sense. So I'm really excited to kind of ask you both the really basic questions and work our way up to the detailed stuff. And the two sessions, which we will explain in a little bit, that have just happened in the first couple of weeks of March, give us an excuse to begin that journey.
I mean, really, they just need to have like a West Wing for China and get people on board.
Yeah, I'm sure the Chinese government would be super supportive of that. just Xi walking very fast through the corridors, just doing walk and talks.
With
inspirational
his
speeches.
But the person contradicts him once and you never see that character again.
The show immediately cancelled.
It's immediately cancelled. The East Wing, get it?
There we go.
Oh my God, Dimitri, we're onto something.
Just jot that down. That's our ticket to riches, I think.
Okay, so let me maybe start with you, Helen. Really, really basic question. How is China governed? People have heard of the Chinese Communist Party. How does China make decisions? How does it work?
Yeah, well, I mean, the best way to think about this is that really Xi Jinping, you know, is the most powerful figure in China's political system. And if you think about the power structure, as if you will, as a concentric circle with him in the middle, and then surrounding him, you've got sort of what I think is a Politburo with seven other people, and then you've got, seven people in total, and then you've got outside of that the 25-member Politburo, and then the various arms that they're responsible for, including
See how complicated and tedious it gets, like, immediately.
I thought that the concentric circle model explanation was going to work. But, you know, if you just imagine that, right, and then, like, outside of that, you've got the state council, the military, the judiciary. But really, if you think about it as, like, a 3D model, got him at the top of the apex of this cone, and then you've got sort of the outside.
He's the central repository of all power in China these days.
Yes, precisely.
Can I also just add to that, Helen? I think it's helpful to go back to understand very briefly the history of the Communist Party and how Communist parties generally govern, right? Because I think that's the biggest difference between democracies and how we operate, is this idea that obviously they fought a revolutionary war, won that in late 1940s, but let's call it 1949 when the PRC was established. The idea of the Communist Party is that it is a party that, it's obviously single party, it's the government, it kind of is everything, but it is this structure that is everywhere in life in China. So, you know, you think about the Tories or the Democrats and, we elect people to the government and then they make government decisions. But, you know, you don't have to be a Democratic Party member to be in the Commerce Department. In China, it's like Communist Party is in your local neighborhood association. That's a Communist Party group. Most big Chinese companies now have a Communist Party board member to make sure that companies are making decisions in line with the national interest. And then, as Helen says, you've got the power brokers in Beijing who are the kind of direction setters for all of these party organs throughout the country to sort of bring the grassroots all the way through the provinces up to Beijing to make sure all of that decision-making is aligned. So, like, it's kind of more than, you know, electing officials to go and make big decisions and all that kind of stuff. It's like this, it's this organism that exists all through Chinese life with Xi Jinping setting the direction for how he thinks China should go. And I think that's kind of important context.
Exactly.
Before you get into explaining, you know, the seven people on the Politburo are the kind of in charge of all their little fiefdoms and whatnot.
Yeah, which is also, I mean, part of it. And, you know, to your point, John, I think there's like 89 million people in the Communist Party.
Yeah.
It's the world's largest political party, if you can call it that.
So I guess to take a half step back, you were describing the Politburo and Xi when you were saying like apex of the pyramid. And, you know, this is an audio format, so you all at home missed out on some truly epic Helen choreography as she acted out all of her models. But so the Politburo, at least in the Soviet Union, was a party organ. It wasn't a state organ. Is there that separate? So is the Politburo formally in charge, or are they the sort of political bit that just sort of informally tells the government what to do?
They're the political bit. I mean, they're meant to be part of the Communist Party.
Yeah. But you know what? I think it's actually, like, technically that is absolutely right. Like, you know, you got, when you learn about, the government is kind of, you know, the foreign ministry, the folks who go abroad and represent China abroad are the government, and they're not the party. They are all party members, of course, in the same way that, like, Dimitri, you might be a member of, you know, UK. Well, you'd be the Brexit party in the UK, I suppose. But,
naturally,
you know, you might be a member of that party in your personal life, but it's kind of irrelevant to your government job. That's what China kind of presents as true, you know, a separate, but realistically, there is absolutely no difference between the two, and that the Politburo is the head of the Chinese government, even though technically it's just the party.
Okay, and Xi is at the top of that. What is Xi's formal title, and how is the person in that position chosen?
That is a great question.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give my very cynical answer. He's whatever title blows in on the wind that day, but, like, you know, technically he's the chairman of the, I think it's general secretary, actually, of the Communist Party.
General secretary
party.
Of the, yeah.
And then he's got, you know, chairman of the consult, all these other titles. And I think they've mooted that he's the core of the Communist Party. There was an argument that he was going to call
the essence.
Yeah, and he was going to call himself the Great Helmsman. The thing about China is there's a lot of, and Helen, this is one that you can correct me on, given that your Mandarin skills are native and mine are very much learned from a white person. but language is super important and symbolic in China.
Yes.
So these titles that sound absurd to us, and I'm not joking when I say, like, the Great Helmsman of the party, that was Mao Zedong's title, and like, it sounds absurd to, like, call Joe Biden the Great Steward of the American People or whatever. But it's like they convey status, and if you're not the helmsman, but you're the something else, you're, like, a little bit lower. And Xi Jinping is very powerful, so there's all these conversations about whether he's going to get these kind of absurd sounding titles.
Mm.
So I think technically he's the general secretary of the Communist Party, but really he's essentially the kind of the supreme leader. He controls everything. Helen, take it from there. I don't know.
I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And the only other thing I want to add is that, you know, Chinese culture and mythology really permeates a lot of the Communist Party and the way that the Chinese people are governed, right? So I think, not without trying to draw you back into too much of the history, like, I think China has historically obviously been a feudal society for thousands of years. And this idea of, you know, an emperor and the dynastical histories of China still permeates through the way that the CCP thinks and looks at the world, right? So this way of thinking, I think, is something that for the West, especially for, you know, the US, which, you know, China sees and says, well, it's a 300-something plus year old country compared to our ancient civilization. And so the framing and the way that they think about this and the importance of historic literary texts is something that, you know, as John highlights, is very much core to the sort of mythology around the CCP and the centrality of Xi Jinping through all of this.
I think a key difference, and maybe it's most useful to kind of keep making analogies back to systems we more implicitly understand to the extent that you can. But, you know, the idea of a Western democratic government is that legislatures pass laws, and then the laws generally have to be followed and, you know, executed and implemented by the government. Mm-hmm. They can't do policies outside of the law anyway, and the courts interpret it. The Chinese system, to me, it's a little different than that. It's, you know, they have the window dressing of courts, and they have the window dressing of legislature and stuff. But really what it is a direction set by the Politburo, by Xi Jinping himself, by the very, very top, the grand poobahs in Beijing. They produce these documents, which we'll get onto in the two sessions discussion. They produce these very sort of dense documents with what seem like very vague instructions around, and again, it sounds absurd to the English speaking ear, which is kind of like, you know, we resolve to work diligently to put Marxism and Xi Jinping at the core of all grassroots work in poverty alleviation. And that will be a policy direction that then every good Communist Party member kind of can know what that means through studying Xi Jinping's thought and all this other kind of stuff. And then at their level, wherever their level is, their job is to kind of interpret that overall direction in their little area of responsibility. So if you're a local official, you then go out and do your job every day, making sure that you are within that kind of very vague direction that you understand because you've studied and researched, and that has meaning, if you get my point.
Can I jump in there? Because I think that's so you just mentioned a policy direction set by the Politburo. In the West, we can generally identify a set of stakeholders that might influence a policy direction that Rishi Sunak might set or Joe Biden might set. We say, look, they have to balance, for example, the internal factions within the Democratic or the Tory party. Mm. They've got like trade unions versus what are some of the forces that might be shaping the Politburo's thinking and Xi Jinping's thinking. Are there any forces like that?
That is a great question. I mean, I think the short answer is there are, but also we don't know anything because it's very difficult to understand what exactly is happening in China, right? And so a lot of the China watchers here, you know, in DC especially, try to read tea leaves and interpret what exactly is happening. But the reality is there's just not a lot of information out there. So we don't know, right? But as much as you can speculate, obviously, I think there are the economic forces and the sort of financial stakeholders who are very much trying to prop up China's economic growth. They're a big sort of concentric force. And then I think, you know, within that, there's the kind of local, like, I mean, China is a huge country with a lot of provinces that have huge, like millions of people in their population. So I think there are certain provinces that have more of a sway than others. As John knows, you've been to some rural visits, right, John, when you were back in China?
Way out west.
Yeah, great stories out there. Yeah, exactly. So I think there's sway from certain provinces that produce, you know, key products that are good for China. And then, I don't know, I mean, jump in here, John. Do you think that there's anyone that I'm missing here?
No, I think the key points there are, one, no one knows. I think that you can go a step further than that, though, and think about a country of a billion people with a GDP of whatever it is and, you know, huge power. And it is absolutely utterly implausible that they aren't suffering the same kind of forces. I shouldn't say suffering, but, you know, dealing with the same kind of forces that a democratic country is dealing with in terms of different stakeholders not agreeing with policy directions and getting shortchanged in this and making their representations into government. Like that, those dynamics absolutely must exist because it is implausible that they don't. We don't know what they are. And I would say the problem arguably, from my perspective, with that system is that I think the more power that Xi Jinping has and the more direct, the more he takes China in a authoritarian kind of back to its Marxist-Leninist roots, away from kind of maybe the Deng Xiaoping direction, which was more open and arguably liberalizing, the more he does that, I think the more the competing forces within China that we don't know what they are, but the more they are less, sort of they're more likely to censor themselves and not robustly contest ideas, or you know, he's less likely to have to balance powerful interests to come up with policy compromises, and more able to do what he thinks is the right thing. And therein lies the fundamental problem with authoritarianism and centralized control and the Communist Party system, is that it doesn't allow for which seems, you know, it's this ongoing debate. You listen to all these clowns in America who go, China, they're so lucky, we should have a system like that because they can plan for 25 years in the head and make all these decisions that, you know, building infrastructure. And you're like,
no one says that anymore, John.
Well, they aren't saying that anymore. That's right. But that was
hanging on TikTok.
It's something I used to deal with all the time. And you know, it is dispiriting to travel in America or Australia where you're like, God, it would take 35 years to build a train line that needs to exist 50 years ago.
But fix a pothole.
Exactly. But the benefit of that is our disputes are out in the public. And generally speaking, most people kind of get heard where they need to get heard-ish. Whereas in China, that is increasingly not the case, which is its fundamental weakness, I think.
Can I wouldn't say push back on it. I'm not sort of advocating one party rule here. But wearing my contrarian hat, if I were the Chinese, I would say, well, hold on, we've got a population of well in excess of a billion people. As many as five decades ago, through a variety of forces, and they would certainly point to colonialist, imperialist oppression here, those were overwhelmingly poor, semi-literate rural peasants, subsistence farming. In the space of 3 to 4 decades, really, we have transformed ourselves into the world's second largest economy. We're making a real bid to own the technology future. And we have actually managed to avoid having any kind of civil war, despite having a population larger than the entire West combined. And the West went to war like every 15 minutes for most of its history. We have avoided sort of major internal strife.
We're all since 1949. I mean, they had a 30-year civil war right before that.
Right. But since the Chinese Communist Party and one-party glorious communist rule came in, they would say, hey, we've managed to maintain stability, which when you are playing with the kind of fireworks we are, is the main thing. And look at all this growth we've produced.
That's an argument they've absolutely made. And it is and Helen, you can jump in a sec. It's something they always say. They brought figures vary, but you know, 400 million, 500 million people out of abject poverty into still poor, but there's a middle class, and there's a general sense it's increasing. And in a lot of ways, the Communist Party's like legitimacy is tied to that narrative. But we just say that narrative that from 1949 we've presided over a general like sort of improving of people's lives. I mean, Mao Zedong killed, by any estimates, you know, tens of millions of people through policies that's made people starve and have to eat their own grandparents' bodies for food and like melt down the tools they were using to farm because Beijing wanted more steel. Like it has not been a linearly good thing. I think you could argue that maybe since the early to mid 80s, it started to definitely improve. And most of what you're talking about, Dimitri, happened from like 1980 to 2015-ish. So like 1949 to now is 80 years. I would argue less than half of that period is the narrative that you've just kind of laid out. However, that is exactly what Chinese diplomats and government officials would tell me every time I met them.
I mean, I agree with that, John. And but the thing is, like, China's never really been given the recognition for lifting people out of poverty, right? Why hasn't any Chinese economist been given like a Nobel Peace Prize for this huge feat? I do think that there is some aspects.
Well, that's a political thing. They try to give it to Liu Xiaobo, right?
Of course, I gave to Liu Xiaobo for the Democracy Pact. But look, I agree. I think there's some aspects where I think China just feels like, okay, well, we've done this huge thing, as Dimitri rightly says. Why doesn't anyone recognize that? But I will also say that China's rise has also come at a time when the world writ large, so the sort of international world order was stable, right? So a lot of the kind of benefits it had derived is also from the West not fighting each other every 15 minutes during the sort of golden decades of the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Not all parts of the West, obviously, but largely.
Well, Japan being neutered after World War II gave North Asia a lot more stability than it traditionally had.
Exactly.
I think it's also worth saying that just as we don't really have a good view of what is influencing Xi's decisions and the Politburo decisions, we also externally don't necessarily have a great view of some of the weaknesses of the Chinese system in how it affects the parts of China that you don't get to see from a conference room when you visit mm-hmm. Beijing for an academic meeting. You know, on this podcast, I've often torn my hair out over people who think they understand Russia because they spent a week in the inner circle of Moscow, kind of going to fancy restaurants and nightclubs and being feted by sort of the tenth of a percent of liberal elites.
Are you referring specifically to Tucker Carlson here?
Well, not. I wish it was just him, but yeah. Discovering that supermarket trolleys can have coins in them to encourage you to return them blew his mind.
And that's all I dealt with in Shanghai, Dimitri, was Australian businessmen coming up and stopping in Shanghai, which is undeniably one of the greatest cities on the planet in terms of modernity and, like, you know, it's just fantastic. It's a fantastic city. And them going, boy, China's way ahead of us. And I'm like, take a train 3 hours east to the west and you'll see that it's still really underdeveloped. It's got lots of problems. But that is also not to say that it's not way better than it used to be.
I mean, it's a generation of people, right? It's my parents' generation, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to go into my own family history here, but I mean, my parents grew up in the Cultural Revolution. They all went to the countryside during the Cultural Revolution to sort of, my dad was like a pig farmer at one point if he's in his college education. And so to sort of have that generation of folks come from that level of poverty to where people are today, right? And they're no longer in China, but their peers in China are doing really well.
Much better.
So it's sort of, it's one generation. I think there is something about that in sort of the psyche of younger Chinese folks today to see the country change before their eyes contributes a lot to kind of the, I think, collective Chinese identity, right? And the Chinese dream, which Xi Jinping has so effectively been able to tap into.
I will say maybe, and this is a good place to pivot to the two sessions, but I do think the unspoken weakness of that model is that it is effectively a quid pro quo exchange. The Chinese Communist Party is trading growth and progress and a sense that your life will be better or your kids' life will be better, significantly better than yours, in exchange for total control. That is the unspoken quid pro quo. And that is a good bargain as long as you say, your parents were pig farmers and now they are tech executives or their lives are significantly improved.
I would go even a step further. I think you're absolutely right that that's what the Communist Party's level social of contract control, they justify it by exactly what you said, Dimitri. But I would add to that and I'd say that's no different from the West. Each party gets elected on that same principle. However, when inevitably things go wrong because progress or development is not linear and things happen and mistakes get made, you have the vent of an election to keep the overall government system social contract in place while changing the people who are, like, implementing that social contract. And the good and the bad of the Chinese system is it is able to get things done because everyone is on the same page. The brittleness of it is it doesn't have those vents to get rid of, to vent mistakes, to course correct, because their whole legitimacy, like their livelihoods, often their lives, Dimitri, as you know, in Russia, are tied up with not losing power, because if they do, they could well be, you know, in a lot of trouble.
There is a saying in sort of the Chinese political system, which is "ni si wo huo," so you die and I live. And that is sort of the way through which, the lens through which I think Chinese political survival is viewed, right? And, you know, Xi Jinping understands this greatly. Like his own father went through this, the purge, when he was in his teens. And he remembers living in some, you know, in rural China somewhere during those
somewhere
years.
Somewhere north,
And so he saw very, very firsthand the kind of brutality of Chinese political survival. And this, again, as I was saying, is descended from the older Chinese feudal dynastical systems in which this term still permeates through Chinese politics.
100%. And it's such an important point, Ellen, because I have often argued with people who don't under, and I, to be clear, I don't understand China in, you know, at all. Like, I understand it maybe a little bit more than the average person, but you can't ever really understand a place like that. I don't think a lot of Chinese people understand how their country fully works.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
One thing I always push back on is this idea that when they come out with statements about win-win, that I fundamentally don't believe the Chinese political system, not the people, but the political system understands the idea in its bones of growing the pie. It is, because what have Helen said, it's like such a permeating culture of, if you lose, I win, and if I lose, you win, and I can't win without someone else losing. That zero-sum game mentality infects everything they do. And for our purposes in geopolitics, it's such an important thing to remember that, like, that even if it's behind the scenes, or even if they're able to kind of put it down in the political system for a while, it is just politically DNA to a revolutionary party, a communist party, a party of revolution, that it is always a struggle, and we must win, because if we don't win, we lose. And I think it's important to kind of interpret China that way.
Right. And last geeky point on this, sorry, is that, you know, John Garneau, who was one of Australia's sort of top China analysts and former journalists there, he had sort of analyzed the way that Chinese politics and the sort of model of communism that China had inherited from the Soviet Union was not the sort of Leninist model, but it was a Stalinist model, which is when Stalin was trying to sort of Soviet Union had really outlived its threats, but they needed sort of to have these invent threats in order to kind of have the propaganda live on, right? And so that model of communism, the Stalinist model, is kind of what this iteration of Chinese communist political thought is based on. I mean, Dimitri, that's your lane, so I'm going to stop wading into it.
No, I think this is really, I mean, as I said, we could have 535 more episodes on this, and I would frankly like to, so clear your calendars. But I did want to get to the headline, which we've deeply buried, but I think very valuably buried. There were two really important, though, as John's saying, potentially dull as rocks, meetings in China at the start of this month. The top political advisory body, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, the CPPCC, met from March 4th to March 10th. And their version of the Congress, the legislature, the National People's Congress, met from March 5th to 11th. Does one of you kind of want to explain what these things are and what came out of them this time?
I mean, I can explain what came out of them this time if John would like to take the fun job of explaining what they are.
Well, I mean, explaining what they are is kind of, it's actually not that important because it's quite tedious. But basically, these are kind of the legislative organs of the Chinese system. So the idea that to the extent there is any democracy, which there really isn't in China, this is the time of the year where all the officials from the provinces, from everywhere, they come to Beijing. And it's a traditional idea that, particularly before internet and before kind of communications, that, you know, you would get reports on the provinces and the districts far away from Beijing. They would all gather once a year and, you know, in times gone by, they would air grievances. They would, you know, say what's going wrong, say what's going right, and kind of inform the power centers of, you know, report on China, report on the provinces. Technically, it's a parliament. They put forward, they deliver work reports, and that's this idea of the leaders kind of saying what was achieved in the year past, and then they set a direction for the year ahead with these kind of long documents that I kind of alluded to earlier. They pass legislation that it's, you know, I think the Western media has kind of settled on this term of like a rubber stamp parliament to kind of get the vibe of what it is. It's not democratic. It's the kind of results are preordained, but it is an element of like, you know, 3,000 delegates from around the country come together. This is the CPC. I can't even remember the acronyms come around and they pass legislation. And that's the kind of vibe of what these two sessions are. They happen at the same time. And yeah, Helen, what comes out?
CPCC. I think that's what.
I've been honestly studying this stuff for a decade, and I still just can't. I don't, it's more that I don't care to get the acronyms right, if I'm honest.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of them also has like sort of, you know, interesting figures or like influential friends of the party, like Jackie Chan comes to one of them, right? CPCC.
And Yao Ming.
Sits there and Yao Ming, exactly, and a bunch of other folks. But no, that's a great explainer, John. But look, this year's what are we calling it? The two sessions. Not exactly sort of, I think nothing, as you say, like nothing spicy came out of it. So I think most people, I think on the foreign policy side, were watching for what was going to happen with Taiwan. But of course, there's no surprises. Beijing is not seeking a cross-strait crisis at this point. And, you know, I don't think they want to maintain the status quo on Taiwan. In terms of the economic stuff, you know, I think now we saw that the economic agenda is now more focused on tech innovation and sort of enhancing productivity, investing in manufacturing to strengthen self-reliance rather than anything else. And then, of course, the market, there are folks who are saying that the Chinese market is now going to try and throw a lot more out into the world, and which might, in terms of producing more stuff because its markets can't absorb as much as it can produce. So that's going to sort of, I think, incite some protectionist responses around the world. And then I think one thing to note as well is that the environmental and sort of climate topics, which had previously, you know, been seen to be more of a front sort of agenda, has been taken a backseat this year, I think probably in line with China's economic challenges that they're facing domestically. And then the other key thing is the technology and military reform. Obviously, that was mentioned this year because the US has cracked down on China, both in terms of the trade and tech barriers that they've imposed through the CHIPS Act and the IRA. So those are sort of, you know, the top highlights of what's happened around the two sessions this year. I don't think there's anything that's more notable than things I've rattled off.
And Helen, you're being, I think, deliberately high level because honestly,
that's what it is.
It's very high, and this is what goes back to what we were saying before, right, about the idea that it's direction setting. It's very generic, or at least what's public is very generic. And you know, there are, you know, China experts including Neil, Helen would come in and be like, well, actually you're wrong about this and that stuff. But I think what we're trying to say is generally this is a time for Chinese system to reflect, to set directions, to report on the year behind it, and kind of publicly give a sign of what's happening.
In terms of that sign, I just wanted to clarify, there've been a lot of debate about, okay, China's economy maybe isn't performing as well as they would like it to.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of debate about what it will do about that. And there was this sense that perhaps they are going to juice consumption. They are basically going to channel stimulus into their consumers. My understanding is that wasn't necessarily what people are interpreting as the signal coming out of this.
That's right. Yeah, there was still a very ambitious growth target, but the stimulus was underwhelming from what we sensed. So I don't think that they can stimulate the market when there's just a lack of, God, I'm running out of words here. I don't think they've been successful at sort of trying to stimulate the market, even though they're going to try to.
They have a lot of other economic problems, you know, savings rates that are ballooning and spending being down in a consumption-driven or trying to be a consumption-driven economy. You know, we could go into the economy stuff, but yeah, I think that's right. Everyone was pretty underwhelmed by, you know, they set a pretty high, I think 5.5% growth target, right, Helen?
Yep.
A lot of, I think, international investors who understand how the Chinese system works better than I do were sort of pretty underwhelmed at the policies that they outlined to get to that growth, I think is the way.
Yeah. Actually, I forgot one thing. There was one sort of rather spicy or like as spicy as it gets thing. There wasn't nothing. It wasn't anything like, you know, people getting escorted out of the meetings or anything. But there usually has been a traditional sort of like press conference that the premier, Chiang, hosts. And then this year they had famously cancelled it because I think everybody has interpreted that as like a departure from transparency and from governance. But I think, you know, other folks are saying that it's a way to kind of downplay the prominence or the public role of the premier, who is second in charge to Xi Jinping. So that was interesting. I mean, I don't think anything that would have been said in that conference would have been all that spicy anyway, but it was just a one point that I think is notable and different from previous years.
I want to wrap up so we finish somewhere vaguely resembling on time.
Dimitri's falling asleep.
Of episode one. No, I'm quite the opposite. And I realize I could keep you guys here for 7 hours with this. But I want to ask you to put a pair of hats on. First, put on the hat, if you are watching this process, you're watching these two sessions as a foreign investor that maybe has been feeling that over the last couple of years, China has changed the dials away from being very welcoming to foreign investment towards more state control, more interference in the market, and has perhaps been feeling the effect of that. So my first question is, if you're watching it from that perspective, did you hear anything that makes you think the rudder is going to pivot in the other direction? And they're going to once again be trying to attract FDI and be a good business environment for FDI? That's question one. And then the second one, if you put on your national security hats, everyone is constantly reading the tea leaves on the Taiwan Strait and geostrategic competition. Did these two sessions strike a belligerent tone? Is this sort of 2021-ish China all over again? John, maybe if you pick one and then Helen does the other.
Yeah, on the first one, without having deep expertise in like investing in China, I think the general sense is you're nuts to be investing or, you know, increasing your positions in China. I think they always, well, since 2015, since Xi Jinping kind of reoriented the Chinese system to be more security driven and less welcoming to outside influence, investment, whatever you want to call it, I think they have tried in periods, in fits and starts, to say the right things because they need foreign direct investment. There's been a ton of capital flight out of China over the last, you know, number of years. But I think no one who is vaguely sensible in a general sense thinks that it's going to reverse itself. So no, China will get, if not get worse, at least stay fairly hostile environment for foreign investment. With the exception that I think if you are in niche areas and you really understand your limited space and marketing and you have, sorry, in investing and you have your thesis is solid and you've got that set up, maybe you can carve out a niche where you can still be pretty profitable. But as a general rule, I think no, the foreign investment environment in China is bad and may get worse. And nothing that Chinese officials are willing to say will ever really change that, I don't think.
Yeah, even if the message this year was like, we're open for business again, right?
They always say that, yeah. But the reality is on the ground, they are not.
Yeah, correct. On the second one, thank you for taking that first one, John. I wanted to take the second one. On Taiwan, I think that was probably one of the more lukewarm good things to have come out of this, which was that it seemed very clear that Xi Jinping and Beijing are not seeking anything that is a cross-strait crisis or anything that would kind of escalate the tensions there. I think that's both domestic. There are two reasons, like domestic as well as international. Domestically, as you've seen, there's a lot of economic troubles that are concerning them. And so they don't want to open up another front. And then secondly, I think internationally, they've seen that there's a lot going on in terms of international crisis. And they're realistic, probably focused on other priorities like the US election later on this year and other elections in their region as well.
Can I say also, this is the Chinese playbook on long-term targets like this. They ratchet up and then ratchet down, ratchet up and ratchet down. The idea being, the ratchet only goes one way and you set a new normal each time you ratchet up. So last year we saw, you know, Pelosi's visit and the massive military exercises around Taiwan in an effort to normalize crossing the median line in the Taiwan Strait, normalize practicing what a blockade of Taiwan would look like, normalize this stuff that 10 years ago would have been close, like that would have almost been a declaration of war, what happened last year, if it happened 10 years ago. And so they ratchet up and then a period of peace and stability comes where the language becomes less bellicose. People sort of settle into this new normal, it being different to the five-year normal. And then, you know, in my gut would be the Chinese system will decide that it's time to ratchet up again at some point in the future. Maybe it's a year or two or three from now. And there'll be something that triggers them and they'll react to it as they often do and they will ratchet up again. What I think is clear is that they are never going to, as long as Xi Jinping is in charge and this Communist Party is the way it is, they will never give up on the goal of Taiwan reunification. They will never give up on the idea they would prefer it to be peaceful if they can. They will try to white ant the Taiwanese political system as much as they can. But if we approach the 100 years of the founding of the CCP in 2049 and Taiwan is still not reunified and is going the other way, I think it will be inevitable that they will try something military. But it, I don't think it's imminent potential, like, you know, touch wood. But
I would say, so
even though I completely agree with Helen that it was ratcheted down this year, I don't think that means anything beyond this is that part of their cycle.
Listen, I could ask a million more questions on this and I will in subsequent shows. But for now, I want to hand it back to John so you can do our perennial
cocktail candle. Maybe we could seek out some feedback to see if whether our like interests align with what people want to hear.
Oh, I don't care.
Or we take that approach of like, they'll the three people who listen will get what they get, what we want them to get.
I don't listen, so it's two people.
We always love to hear from like what you'd like us to do more of, listen to, what you want to hear more from. I'm fascinated by this, but you don't have to be.
Well, thank you. I think it was a really interesting conversation. Yeah, maybe we can touch on it again. There's no shortage of interesting stuff to talk about. But this bit is how we end our podcast to make sure people don't go away with just, you know, a relatively bad taste in their mouth. Let's call this bit the sorbet of the podcast. Helen, what's interested you this week? What are you going to be chatting about this weekend?
Obviously the Kate Middleton situation. I mean, is she okay? No one knows. Where is she? I mean, the question on everyone's minds. I mean, look, I have been strangely pulled into this because somehow the royals have a real like hold over Gen Z, right? And half of my team are Gen Z, and so a lot of them are really interested in all of this. So I've been delving into sort of the party that's been investigating what's happening with Kate Middleton, which is famously she hasn't been seen in public for the last couple of months. And then she, or somebody, the firm, is that what we call the royals? Yeah, the firm produced a photo of her with the three kids. And then, of course, AFP and other sort of media sources took it down because they said it was doctored. Well, it was a manipulated image. And then she apparently then put out a statement to say that, you know, like all amateur photographers, I sometimes experiment with photo editing. But is she, I don't know, is she actually, was she the person who put it out? Who knows? And then in amongst all this intrigue, you know, we've seen that Meghan Markle has returned to Instagram. So look, that is a sort of really heavy hitting things that I will be talking about at this weekend.
You guys can't see, but while Helen was telling us that, Kate Middleton walked across the back of her video feed twice.
Correct.
Yeah, she looks hungry and thirsty, Helen. treat her better. Well, I can't even pretend I care at all about any of that. So, I imagine the reaction from you is going to be the same about what I'm going to be chatting about, which is the Oscars. I know that's kind of like 5 days
old. No, I care about the Oscars.
Okay, good. There.
Love the Oscars.
Couple of things. One, I thought it was a really strong year for Oscar-nominated movies. They were all pretty good films, but I also think that Oppenheimer was probably the worst film out of the lot, and it won everything. I was pulling for Anatomy of a Fall. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but I just thought it was such a fantastic movie about like something fairly mundane, you know, like a kind of like a courtroom drama-ish, but it didn't go into like the evidence or anything. It was just this amazing bit of acting about, you know, what it would like to be on trial for a crime potentially that you committed, potentially you didn't. It left it ambiguous. Mm. The German actress at the heart of it did like had me eating out of her hand. She was such a good performance. I was upset that it didn't win, but I thought, I don't know if you've seen The Holdovers, the Paul Giamatti movie.
Yes,
that
I
was
love
fantastic as well.
Yes.
So I really was like looking forward to this year's Oscars, and I was like, you know, you're always pulling for the movie you like to win. But also the ceremony was kind of good. Like it just, I don't know. I was kind of glad to see that.
No punches.
Nothing annoying happened. It was enjoyable, and I was just happy that there's these monoculture events that kind of seem to be cropping up a bit more, where a bunch of people all watch the same thing and can talk about it the day after, rather than this like, oh, did you see this thing that I watched on YouTube that, you know, five other people have seen? I'm going to bore you about it for 5 minutes. It's like, oh no, most people saw the Oscars. Most people have seen a film that happened at the Oscars, and it's nice to talk about it at cocktail parties and have the return of that after whatever COVID was. Anyway.
I couldn't agree more, John, but I want to say one thing about Anatomy of Fall, which is that they did win an award for the dog won the Goodest Boy Award at the Oscars.
Oh, okay. Good.
Did you see that?
I mean, pissing on Matt Damon's star on the Walk of Fame, which I truly enjoyed that little cut to. Did you see that?
No, I didn't see that.
They filmed the dog literally lifting his leg and urinating on Matt Damon's star, which, chef's kiss. Dimitri, what are you talking about?
Ben Affleck's been training it to do that for 15 years.
Absolutely.
No, I wanted to stay on the theme of acting and performances, because this week the voting starts in the Russian presidential elections. And I mean, it's obviously absurd, but one thing that's always kind of tickled me is that the way that we report it in the West is that we tend to say, oh, these elections are on. And then, of course, you know, it's the news reporter will turn to the camera and say, but obviously this is Russia, so this isn't real. And I feel like that's a halfway house. I feel like we're sort of tokenizing the fact that they're having elections, but then we feel like we need to qualify it. I will be telling people that I think we should go the exact opposite direction. and treat it as if we are pretending that this is completely legitimate, super competitive, and keep interviewing Russians as if it's like a hotly contested presidential race.
Like a sports event.
They can maintain the facade. To be just like, oh, do you think he's going to pull it out? Like, ooh, there's a lot of forces in the country pushing against it. What do you think he'll say in the debates?
Yeah.
How do you think he'll poll?
That's pretty good stuff.
How long do you have to push the Russian ambassador to the US or whatever before he goes, you guys understand this is not real, yes?
I like it. That's a good approach.
That commedia dell'arte aspect to it, I just think we should lead in. And that's what I'm going to be telling people at cocktail parties.
Daily Show producers, I hope you're listening.
It's my dream. Bring me back, John.
I mean, we covered that very briefly today in our newsletter, and we did say that. It's like, yo, the elections, obviously there's no doubt about the result, but I like leaning into that and like just seeing how many people notice if we were like, honestly, polls are pretty undecided at this point, and you know, this guy that no one's ever heard of might be the next president of Russia.
we spoke to diners at a small cafeteria in Smolensk.
and they were evenly split. Yeah, exactly. All right, folks, we've run late again. We always do that again, on this podcast, but hopefully you found it interesting. It's a delight to be with you each week. Keep your feedback coming in. It does genuinely help us tailor our content to what you're more interested in. Helen, thank you as always for helping me kind of somewhat demystify China. Appreciate your time.
Of course, and I'll be back in Australia next week. So, you know, those who are in Sydney, hit us up for the Intrigue event in Sydney.
Yes, that's a good point. Very big plug for that. Intrigue is hosting its first event in the wild in Sydney. So we'll have a bit of a debrief from you after that.
Yeah.
Dimitri, a joy as always. Thanks for playing the normie and keeping us somewhat on the level, although we mostly talked over you, I realize.
Listen, I'm used to it. No, thanks so much, guys. I genuinely could pick your guys' brains about China forever, because the sense of guilt I have for not understanding the most important actor in the 21st century is crippling.
Well, fair enough. Thank you very much for your time. And I'm John Fowler, and thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back next week.
Dialogue editing, mixing, and mastering for this episode was done by Marissa Ewing of Hemlock Creek Productions.